from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, a local professor and his new book, 2 Billion Cars. Also, poet Tim Bellows, whose works are inspired by nature and spirituality. But first, members of Congress are in their districts today to talk about what's going to happen to the federal economic stimulus money. Among them, Democrat Doris Matsui and Republican Dan Lundgren, both of whom represent Sacramento area districts. What did each have to say about the stimulus package? Capital Public Radio news reporter Ben Adler talked with them both, and he joins us. Ben, welcome back.
Hey, Jeffrey.
Congresswoman Matsui spoke at a meeting of a couple hundred local business and education leaders. What did she have to say about the stimulus package?
Well, when I caught up with her, I asked her how an individual infrastructure project, whether it's built by a developer or a city or a county, would go about getting a piece of the pie.
We need to know if they're really worthy projects, they're ready to go. That means that they've gone through all their permitting and all of that, contracts awarded, and so that they could actually start. And so we will be dealing with this mostly through the states and then also through, for instance, as far as transit, for the transit agencies. And they have many, many projects that they'll have to look over to see which ones might be the most worthy one to begin.
Transit agencies like?
Oh, like RT, Regional Transit. Certainly they're more aware of what needs to get done. Caltrans certainly is at the state level, so they'll be working with Caltrans in order to ensure that the right projects get funded and get moving.
A lot of local officials, while the bill was still in conference committee in Washington, were saying, please, 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 don't send the funds through the state. Send them directly to local government and regional bodies like SACOG, the Sacramento Area Council of Governments, which does road work and other construction projects in this area. The state is, at this point, appearing to be quite dysfunctional. What confidence can voters have and local governments have that the money's going to make its way down to these projects in a quick manner when they got to go through the state?
Well, we're hoping that, certainly in California especially, that they get around to dealing with their crisis. We believe that the recovery package and the fact that we have the state fiscal stabilization funds and the fact that we're helping them with Medicaid and unemployment benefits and things of that nature, that will help in this crisis. I realize with the state crisis today, hopefully they pass the budget. There'll be some lag time probably for them to get things going. But quite frankly, the federal funding is still going to move toward them. And hopefully that by the time they get their budget, funding will be there and they could go.
So you trust the state to handle the federal stimulus funds and get them to the local level?
Well, that's all we can do right now. And quite frankly, I believe that we have put some safeguards on this. In 120 days, if 50% of it is not done, then they're going to have to say why, or they're going to give the money back. And a lot of that is there because if the project is not using the money effectively, there are other places to use it. We'll pull the money back and put it into another worthy project.
Say there are several projects from a region or several projects from competing regions. How is it figured out who's going to get the money?
Well, this is where we're happy here because in this region we have SACOG. We've already looked at a lot of these projects and pretty much have prioritized them to see which one should go first. And we've certainly had a backlog on this, so there's a clear understanding about what we must do. And I think we've been really lucky in this region in particular because we have had a lot of cooperation. And let's just face it, if we don't fight about it, we can get a lot further along and we can support each other in projects that might necessarily not be in our backyard but will be helpful for the whole region. And certainly there's reciprocity there too.
And real quick, could you name a couple of specific projects that you think the Sacramento region will see progress on before the end of the year?
I think that we have some good projects as far as light rail, especially in the South Line there. I think that's really very important to look at. And I also believe, too, we have a lot of deferred maintenance. We can see it all around the roads. And I think if we look at Highway 80 or Highway 50, we'll see some progress there. I believe that you will start seeing the big equipment coming out. And I think that's really very important for all of us. In flood protection, you'll probably see some action there, too.
Natomas levees?
Natomas levees are something that we're going to be working on that's going to be outside of the stimulus because of the fact that its very nature puts it outside the stimulus. the Army Corps of Engineers has designated $2 billion, which, you know, we could use $2 billion just like that. So for us, it's going to take a bigger hunk than that, but it will do. It'll be helpful in some of the areas in American River that we're still working on, certainly Folsom Dam. So it'll be helpful.
Today, the president is announcing his plan to aid home foreclosures or reduce the number of home foreclosures. And what can you tell us about that plan so far that you've heard about?
Well, obviously, I don't have the details of that plan, but we all know that the housing crisis really at the bottom of what's happening now as far as the whole economic crisis that we're going through. I've always believed that we needed to attack the housing crisis, and the president is very much getting involved in this now. I believe he's looking at maybe $75 billion out of the TARP, which is the Troubled Assets Program, to really go into the heart of this. And many, and I, you know, okay, there are many things that he will be doing there, one of which is really to encourage and incent the banks or the lending agencies to work with those individuals who are on the brink of foreclosure or into foreclosure to look at their loans, to make sure that maybe perhaps they can readjust them so they can actually make the payments. We also have part of it in there, too, is that if there are distressed areas, and this is adding on to a plan that we already have, it's really a neighborhood revitalization plan in which certain agencies, like the redevelopment agency, money will be given to them to actually purchase homes and revitalize them in order to sell. So that's part of it, too, to keep neighborhoods intact. And Sheila Bair, FDIC chair, had a plan a long time ago, which I believe that they sort of pursued. She realized that if you look at some of these mortgages, you can already identify some already that are going to be fine, you know, and they're, and just get them off the books and readjust them and get them going. And that's part of the plan I know that President Obama has.
That was Congresswoman Doris Matsui, a Democrat from Sacramento, speaking this morning with Capital Public Radio news reporter Ben Adler. She and other members of Congress are in their districts today talking about the recently passed federal economic stimulus package. Ben, Congressman Dan Lundgren also spoke today in Sacramento. Unlike Matsui, who's a Democrat, I'm guessing Lundgren, who's a Republican, has a different take on the federal stimulus package.
I think that'd be a pretty safe bet. I met Congressman Lundgren at a Public Policy Institute of California discussion this morning on the stimulus package. It was in downtown Sacramento. He was one of many panelists. And before we spoke, the congressman sat quietly in the back of the room, listened to Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer speak, who was there too. And then I started by asking Lundgren if he looks at the stimulus any differently now that it's passed, given that he voted against it twice.
Well, I want to make sure that the stimulus that's in the package is spent appropriately and that California gets what it was supposed to get. But I'm still disappointed in it. We had an alternative, which we presented, which by the analysis under the methodology that was promulgated by the president's economic advisors would have produced twice as many jobs at half the cost, and those jobs would have been produced much more quickly. And that's what a stimulus is supposed to be. So I'm not going to try and stand in the way of it if that's what you mean, but the fact of the matter is, if this is used as the first in a number of steps toward bigger and bigger government, it's going to be disastrous for our kids. We pass this, there's going to be a $410 billion omnibus bill coming down the pike in a couple of weeks, followed by a $100 billion stimulus package. That's going to require the federal government to go to the debt market for $2.1 trillion this year. That's never been done by any country in the history of the world. It's four times larger than we've ever done it. And you have to ask, what is the cost of the bill? Is it worth it? And I have to look my children, my grandchildren in the face and say, am I doing the right thing for you? And I very much fear that we could follow down the path of Japan, which had a series of stimulus packages, one after the other, which resulted in much more debt, a tremendous drop in their GDP, in tremendous increase in the percentage of debt as a percentage of GDP, and resulting in what's known as a lost decade. I don't think we can afford a lost decade here.
Are there portions of the stimulus bill that you think can help your constituents in a quick manner?
Well, to the extent that 18% of it or 17% of it is geared towards infrastructure, there are certain infrastructure needs we have. In this area, levees would be number one. I mean, we still have to protect ourselves against the ravages of nature when we do have rain in this area and when we do have those problems that do occur. Secondly, there are highway projects that certainly could be done. But if you truly wanted to stimulate the economy, we would have put a lot more money directed at accelerating the procurement lines for the Defense Department, because everyone knows we have chewed up our equipment in our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. All you have to do is go down the road and talk to the people at the California National Guard who've served over there, where they took their equipment, had to leave it. We could right away, without a moment's notice, accelerate those production lines and get equipment back for our men and women in uniform, both here and abroad, and not crowd out private capital, meaning that these are things that we know we have to do in the not-too-distant future. You accelerate that by about a couple of years, that's the time when we need the stimulus.
Can you name a project or two in your district that you feel is well-positioned to get some of these funds and that your constituents might see some progress on in the next year?
Well, I've spoken to a number of the folks representing cities and counties in my district, and they have talked about lists that they have looked at. For instance, I was talking to people in Rancho Cordova just yesterday, and they talked about how they had come up with like an A and a B list, and the A list actually would be able to be done as soon as possible. Now, that is assuming that it can get by environmental review. And one of the things that's missing in the package that I hope we would have is an acceleration of the review period from an environmental standpoint on any of these projects, so that we could make sure that they would get done. Not forgetting about the environmental concern, but accelerating and consolidating any appeals that might take place. So folks in my district have told me that they do have projects that they think they define as shovel ready. We'll see whether they meet the standards that are in this bill.
Well, for example?
Well, they were talking about a number of different highway projects or freeway projects that were in their district, that sort of thing.
And finally, the president today is announcing his plan to help solve the foreclosure problem right now. Your district obviously has a lot of foreclosures in it as well, in this whole region. What do you want to see in the president's plan, and what's the Republican plan to help?
Yeah, we'll have to see what the president's details are. What I have tried to say is let's look at the two experiences of other countries over the last couple of decades. One is Japan's experience, one is Sweden's experience. I would hope we would follow the Swedish experience. The Swedish experience was one in which they came forward, recognized the extent of the toxic assets with certain banks, allowed some banks to actually fail, had some government assistance for setting up what were known as side-by-side bad banks, not one national bad bank, but a number of banks that had bad assets or toxic assets from already existing banks that otherwise would be able to perform. And you set up a scheme in which those toxic assets are sequestered off, and they can hold them for a period of time until they begin to get some of their value back. What Japan did, and the mistake they made, was not recognizing the size of the problem, allowing to be created what became to be known as zombie banks, banks that didn't have the capacity to actually operate but were being held up by government subsidy, thereby postponing the day of reckoning. We need to sort those things out in that regard. And the Republican proposal, we had a certain type of tax treatment for people who were making purchases or people with already existing mortgages to help them through this period. Seems to me we ought to be inventive enough to bring those things together.
Republican Congressman Dan Lundgren speaking this morning with Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler. Ben, just finally, after following this in the news and listening to these two interviews, one thing I'm still not clear on is how exactly projects to be funded will be chosen and how the money is going to flow.
Well, me neither. And I think actually there are a lot of people who don't know this, and a lot of people included in that in Washington, D.C. right now. And certainly here in Sacramento, there are more questions than answers at this point. But there are a lot of different ways that the funds are going to be distributed. So, for example, some are going to go straight to the states to fund Medicaid, or in California, it's Medi-Cal, unemployment benefits. I believe those are going through the states. There's also, you know, some projects, infrastructure projects that are going to be funded through the state, others that might go straight from the federal government to local governments, different ways of being distributed. For example, formulas of a certain amount of money to a certain area based on population, or competitive grants where people or regions compete for funds. I talked with the developer of the Rail Yards, which is a project in downtown Sacramento, a major infill project that's trying to get a lot of money from the stimulus. And this morning they said they're just starting to look through the 1,000-page bill. They don't know exactly what's out there for them. They know there's something for them there, hopefully lots of somethings in their opinion, but they don't quite know exactly what yet. And a big concern I've heard from a lot of local officials this past week or two is the lack of a state budget and the effect that could have on the ability of local projects to get stimulus funds that have to travel through the state first. You heard me ask Representative Matsui a few minutes ago if she trusted the state to get the money processed, and she basically said, we have to.
Capital Public Radio News reporter Van Adler. Today he spoke with two local Sacramento area members of Congress, Doris Matsui and Dan Lundgren, about the federal economic stimulus package. Ben, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a local professor and his new book, 2 Billion Cars. I'll talk with Dan Sperling about it and his recent appearance on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can podcast Insight. Sign up at capradio.org/insight. Do you remember watching the A-Team or the Rockford Files on TV? Ever wonder about the person who wrote and produced them? Tomorrow in Insight, you'll meet writer Stephen J. Cannell and hear about his latest project. Also, Vive la Food, a locally made documentary that tells the story of two French chefs who've made their livings in Sacramento. Did you see The Daily Show with Jon Stewart last Wednesday?
My guest tonight, a professor at UC Davis, who also serves on the California Air Resources Board. He co-authored the new book, 2 Billion Cars, Driving Towards Sustainability. Please welcome to the show, Daniel Sperling.
As you probably know, The Daily Show is political satire. You'll get serious guests talking about serious things. But Jon Stewart will follow up in ways Bill Moyers could only dream of. For example, here's Dan Sperling answering a question about biofuels.
I think the future is going to be some mix of advanced biofuels, not corn ethanol.
You're down on corn ethanol. You have a chapter entitled, Corn Ethanol, That. I'm very surprised to see that.
Sperling's book has attracted a lot of attention. He was also recently on Fresh Air. I caught up with him yesterday and asked how he reacted when he calculated there would be 2 billion cars in the world in about 15 years.
It was a very shocking experience to think that there would be so many. You know, the number 2 billion doesn't seem so big these days with talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. But in Washington, but 2 billion cars is really in many ways a frightening prospect.
How many cars do we have roughly right about now?
Well, now we have over 1 billion vehicles, about 750 million cars in the world, and the rest are cars, are trucks, buses, motorcycles. And we'll be hitting 2 billion vehicles by 2020.
Well, it's taken us about 100 years or so to get to 1 billion plus. How can we possibly nearly double that in about 15 years? Because the population of the world is not going to double in that time.
No, it's a matter of, as people become more affluent, more and more of them buy vehicles. There's about 6.5 billion people in the world today. And, you know, in China and India and Brazil, people are becoming much more affluent. And one of the first things they purchase as soon as they can is a car.
My guest is Daniel Sperling. He's a transportation expert and co-author of 2 Billion Cars, Driving Towards Sustainability. He's a professor at UC Davis, where he's also founding director of the Institute of Transportation Studies. He's also a member of the California Air Resources Board. Why should we be concerned about the prospect of 2 billion cars in the world?
Well, we should be pleased that so many people are going to be having mobility around the world. That's the good news. But we should be frightened by what that implies in terms of oil use and greenhouse gases.
But what if those cars are not largely driven by oil? I mean, I realize that right now the chances are the vast majority will be powered by oil. But what if they weren't? Would it still be a problem?
It would be much less of a problem. It creates different issues, different places, but from a global perspective, it becomes not a problem. And that means, the big global issues, that really face humanity that are probably the biggest challenges are this question of oil and the tension over oil supply and the wars and so on that it causes, and the climate change that results from all of that CO2 being released from the combustion of the petroleum.
Based on current trends and your take on the state of things in the world, what percentage of those 2 billion cars are likely to be powered by something other than gasoline in, let's say, 2020?
Well, today the only place where there's a significant number of vehicles not powered by petroleum is in Brazil, where they use ethanol made from sugarcane. By 2020, we're going to see more biofuels. We're going to see more electricity, and by that time, we should be seeing some hydrogen also being used in vehicles. But by 2020, it's going to still be, pretty much near the beginning of the change process, or at least not so far along. By 2030, I think there'll be much more penetration by electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids and fuel cell electrics and some of the better biofuels. But it's only going to happen, it's not going to just happen by itself. And it's only going to happen if there's some real leadership in terms of adopting the policies that are needed. In California, the good news is we are moving forward and we are making good progress in adopting the kind of policies needed. But the rest of the country and the rest of the world also need to follow along.
You mentioned that in Brazil they use ethanol made with sugar cane. In the United States, ethanol is mainly made with corn. But corn is not considered one of the better biofuels, right?
No, it's one of the least attractive, and that's because it uses a lot of energy to produce it. It's expensive. It uses a lot of land, and it competes with food production, which is troublesome in many levels.
When you see someone driving around in a hybrid, a Toyota Prius, for example, how happy should they be about their choice? Does it make a significant difference, your carbon footprint, driving a hybrid as opposed to a regular gasoline-powered car?
It does. It makes a difference because a Prius or a Civic hybrid, they're about 40 to 50% better fuel economy, so they use about a third less gasoline compared to a comparable car, but, and even better compared to an SUV, of course. But it's even more important than that. It's important because of the actual improvement they are making in their particular car, but it's also important because of the signal it sends to the auto industry and to policymakers that these people believe we need to do things differently. And it's voting with your dollars. It's telling, those car companies there is a market for these more fuel-efficient vehicles, and you folks should be making more of these and promoting them more.
Are hybrids transitional technology, or are they the future?
They're a transitional technology because the hybrids, as we know them today, still run on gasoline, and we need to get off of petroleum, and we need to get to a much lower carbon fuel. Right now, we're thinking that we need about an 80% reduction in the amount of carbon released. And when you go to a hybrid vehicle, at best, you'll get a third reduction. So we need something more than that. We need to decarbonize our fuels. So the next step after the hybrid vehicles is a plug-in hybrid, which several companies are going to start selling in about a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
Year or two, and that'll be the next step, because then those cars run on a mixture of electricity, from the outlet, from the grid, and the gasoline, and so, that's a step towards shifting away from petroleum use.
You said that hybrids send a message to the car companies that there is a market for more fuel-efficient vehicles. But up until a couple of years ago, the U.S. auto industry said that they made a lot of gas guzzlers because the people of the United States made it clear to them that that's the kind of car they wanted to drive. Now, I understand that more fuel-efficient vehicles have sold more in the last year or so as gas prices went up, but it seems to me they're still not a significant part of the automobile market in the United States.
It's increasing, but you're right, it's still not a large number. But, you know, you have to think about, you know, the car companies have always said we're just giving the customers what they want. But the reality of the world is that, you know, individuals are always going to want more of, you know, they want bigger houses, they want bigger cars. You know, not everyone, but, you know, most of them. And so, but if everyone got, you know, what they wanted, what their own little desires were, then, you know, the world would collapse. It wouldn't function. And in this case, because of the oil use and the competition for the oil and the carbon emissions causing climate change, so we need leadership that creates policy that tells customers that, you know, if you buy a more fuel efficient vehicle, then you're going to be rewarded, and does the same thing with the car companies. And, you know, that's kind of one policy to do that is something called feebates. And California is seriously considering this now, and that is if you buy a car that's a gas guzzler, then you have to pay an extra fee. But if you buy a very fuel efficient vehicle or a low greenhouse gas vehicle, then you get money back. So now you're being rewarded for doing the right thing.
Daniel Sperling is co-author of 2 Billion Cars Driving Towards Sustainability. He's a professor of civil engineering and environmental science and policy at UC Davis. How do you think cars are principally going to be powered in the future? And what do you think they should be powered by if it's something other than what you think they will be powered by?
Well, we need to get off fossil energy. So that's you know, that's clearly understood. It would be hubris of a, you know, huge order to for me to say exactly what the solution is. But I think what we can say with confidence is there's three sets of fuels that are that will power our vehicles in the future. And that's biofuels, that's electricity, and that's hydrogen. And eventually all of our vehicles will be powered, almost if not all, will be powered by those three sets of fuels. Now, there's different ways of making them, and there's a lot of questions about how do we get there, but I think there's no issue or no question that that is where we're going to end up eventually.
What if people in America, which obviously is an important part of the world automobile market, what if they just never in very large numbers take fuel-efficient vehicles to heart? What could be done about that?
Well, we can't let that happen, you know, and that is what's happened the last 20 years. And you've seen, you know, the tension that's resulted from that in terms of oil use. We've seen how much oil use has increased and how much CO2 is increasing. You know, over the last 20 years or so, we barely changed our fuel economy standards in the United States. And we did have them in there. And the effect that they had was that vehicles became more fuel efficient in a technical sense. There's a lot of innovation to make the technology better, but all of it was used, all of that efficiency improvement was actually diverted to making the vehicles bigger and more powerful. And so, for instance, 20 years ago, a car would go 0 to 60 miles per hour in 14 and a half seconds. That was the average. Today, that same average car would go 9.5 seconds. So it's 14 and a half, now it's 9.5. Cars today are so much more powerful, so much faster. And the result of that is they guzzle a lot more fuel, you know, certainly a lot more fuel than they have to. So if we had just kept that the same performance level that they of 20 or 25 years ago, today's vehicles, you know, presto, just like that, would be 30% more efficient.
Mm-hmm. But still, I've got to come back to the consumer. If the consumer does not respond in the way that policymakers want them to, who's responsible for turning that around? You said that can't be allowed to continue. Is it up to the government, or is it up to the industries involved, the automobile and the fuel industries?
Well, everyone has to play a role in it. But the way it has to work is we have to create the policy that sends a signal to industry and the consumers, you know, to change and to do it in the way we want it. So what that means is we talked about a feebate idea a moment ago where people get an incentive to buy it, and it's also an incentive to industry to make those more fuel-efficient vehicles. We could do something else like setting a price floor for gasoline, so or having a gas tax or gas fee placed on the price of gasoline so that people will be rewarded, you know, for doing this, you know, the right thing. And I just don't see any way around it, because people are, you know, they're going to respond. You know, you make a calculation. You go to the store, go to buy a car, you make a calculation about how much it costs and how much you'll save. And so we have to be able to create the policy that directs our whole society, our consumers, and our industry in the right direction.
Do you see mass transit as being part of the solution to mitigating the problems that will almost certainly happen in a world with 2 billion cars?
Yes, I do see mass transit playing a role, but it's a different kind of mass transit than we have today. You know, today, mass transit, you know, cars and buses, they provide about 2.5% of passenger travel in the U.S. Only 2.5%. Cars have essentially vanquished transit everywhere except in the dense downtowns of the older cities. And so we need a new approach to transit, and that means using information technologies mostly.
How do you mean?
Well, you know, we had this information technology revolution in the 90s. You'd barely notice it in the transportation sector, and that it's barely changed the transportation sector and mobility services. So, for instance, why can't we have vans that actually come to our door? We just call them up through a cell phone or internet. They come pick us up, take us where we're going in a real-time basis. We can have smart carpooling. You know, many of us go to the same office to work or go to the same school or go to the same ball game, and we don't know who else is going and when they're going. It would be very simple just to use information technologies to get us more coordinated, and there are companies that provide that service for doing it. And these are, you know, car sharing, these are the kinds of ideas we need to get out there, and the result would be people would actually drive less. It would cost them less money. They would drive less. It would cost them less money, and in many cases, they'd be getting better service because many of us, you know, do we all really want to get up in the morning and, you know, struggle through a car, you know, congested traffic and need to find a parking? Wouldn't we rather be chauffeured? You know, many of us would be. Most of us probably would be. And if we could get rid of a car, you know, a car costs you, on average, $8,000 per year. Every car that we own, to the cost of owning and operating that vehicle, is $8,000 every year.
But there's a convenience that comes from having your own car that's sitting waiting for you outside your house, sitting waiting for you outside your office.
Yeah, but there's also a convenience of being chauffeured around. And you think, you know, you can work in the vehicle. These can be nice vehicles. If you have, you know, you can get a higher quality service if you want. And if you don't have to pay that $8,000 a year, you can afford a lot of these other services. You can have car sharing nearby. So, for instance, also, sometimes you might want a pickup truck to go bring something somewhere else, or maybe one morning you want to take a sports car out for a drive. You know, right now you can't do that. You could go to a car rental and everything involved in that. So people kind of think we have the ideal transportation system now. We don't. It's expensive, and there's a lot of downsides to it.
Everyone is still trying to digest the federal stimulus package, and if you haven't had a chance to really study it from a transportation perspective, that's fine. We'll move on. But as far as you understand, does the federal stimulus package, which does have a lot of money supposedly for green technologies and certainly for transportation infrastructure spending, does that help move the country more towards a direction of having cars that don't rely on gasoline?
That piece of it does. It provides some assist, some tax credits for plug-in hybrids and electric vehicles, and that's good. It does not do anything for the kinds of ideas I was talking about creating more mobility services. You know, it tends to be, you know, it's fairly conservative because, you know, they have this idea that we want to spend the money immediately, you know, the idea of shovel-ready projects. And so it tends not, you know, it has some good things in it, but it's not focused on actually reforming our transportation system or stimulating innovation.
And finally, Daniel Sperling, with your book 2 Billion Cars, you've had a lot of interest from national media. You were on Fresh Air. You were recently on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. What was that like, being interviewed by Jon Stewart? And I ask that because they do cover serious topics, but in an irreverent way. How did you prepare for it?
Well, you know, I did try to prepare for it, but it was useless. The guy is so hilarious and so funny, and he just goes off on whatever tangents, you know, appeal to him, and I had no idea where he was going. I mean, I thought he was going to, you know, make jokes about Governor Schwarzenegger, who wrote the foreword to the book. He didn't do any of that. So it was an experience of just kind of staying with the guy, you know, okay, we're going for a ride here, and I try to get in a few points that are serious points, and I did get a few in there, but it was mostly, it was also entertainment.
Did they give you any guidance about how to approach an interview like that?
No, you know, they put some makeup on me, and that was about it.
And how long was the actual interview, do you know? Because what we see is an edited version.
No, it's not an edited version, actually. They did tape it beforehand, so I went in there, and the taping, they taped the whole show all at once. So they do the taping like 6 to 6:30, and then they show it a few hours later at 11 p.m. But they usually don't, as I understand, they don't make any changes in it unless something, I guess, really serious happens.
And what was it like watching yourself on The Daily Show afterwards?
Well, you know, at the end of the show, I thought, well, that was fun. I really enjoyed it. But I didn't feel like I had really communicated much. I felt like I was just kind of following him along and, you know, his jokes. But when I watched it, I actually felt better, even better about it. I felt like, well, I did communicate a few important ideas. So I felt even better about it. So he's a very decent guy. He was, I mean, not only is he funny, but he was really nice. He came talk to me beforehand to kind of calm me down, make, you know, so that I would realize he wasn't some, you know, ogre or wasn't going to humiliate me or something like that. And he wasn't much taller than me, which made me feel good also.
Daniel Sperling, transportation expert, co-author of 2 Billion Cars, Driving Towards Sustainability. He's a professor at UC Davis. He's a member of the California Air Resources Board and much more. Dan, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, poet Tim Bellows. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Did you disagree with something you heard on Insight? Tell us what it was and why at insight@capradio.org. Coming up this afternoon from Capital Public Radio News, Republicans in the California Senate dump their leader and elect someone new. What impact is this having on the long-running budget negotiations? That story and more later today on All Things Considered. Local writer Tim Bellows is working on a new book. His poetry is inspired by wilderness, spirituality, and philosophy. His themes include the nature of death and truth. A graduate of the famous Iowa Writers' Workshop and twice nominated for a Pushcart Prize for his poetry, Bellows has been published in over 200 literary journals. He also teaches at Sierra College in Rocklin. He's in our studio. Tim Bellows, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Your previous collection of poems was titled Sunlight from Another Day, Poems in and Out of the Body. What does that mean, poems in and out of the body?
Well, I like to think of my poetry and much poetry actually as being grounded in physical reality, using hard images, talking about physical things and emotional situations perhaps, but also to take us perhaps out to another level of consciousness, if that's possible, through words, through the sounds of the words or what they're saying. So it's both important to be in the body so you can hang in and live in this world, and it's important to get out once in a while, I believe, for me.
And the grounded aspect, is that so that the poems resonate more clearly and in a more concrete way for readers?
Right. Yeah, you talk about shovels and earth and whatever, you know, if that's appropriate. And it grounds it, and it makes us feel we have a common experience, a shared experience in the reality of the poet.
And what is the spiritual, philosophical perspective that you have that connects to the out-of-the-body part of your poems?
Well, I believe, and many others really do, that words have a power in the way their tones and sounds interact. And they actually have a power to lift spirit, if you will. Take the Lord's Prayer or take some great passages from Shakespeare. You know, they're extremely moving and they're very high language, very powerful. And And I think that's the key, is the sound of the words.
And is that something that poetry, in your opinion, does better than other kinds of literature?
Well, it tends to, yeah. Short stories do it too, but poetry is very concentrated. I look at poetry as speaking singingly, to speak in a singing way. So we have words like stream and dreams, perhaps, or dread and federal. Those might go together pretty well. Anyway, in other words, we have kind of resonating sounds of the words aside from rhyme that make it, that give it a charge in a way. Hard to describe.
My guest is Tim Bellows, poet. His most recent collection of poems is Sunlight from Another Day, Poems in and Out of the Body. You're going to read for us a poem that's from Sunlight from Another Day, and this poem is called Night Passages. Is there anything you'd like to say about the poem before you read it, or would you like to just launch
into
the poem?
I'd like to say a couple of things. It's basically about a shift in consciousness, because I find that the most important thing is to shift your consciousness into a higher level, and we all can do that. It's not just for a few saints or a few holy men. So this is about dreaming and going to sleep and dreaming, and yet if you're working on perhaps what I could say is a higher consciousness, your dreaming becomes a real journey, an actual spiritual journey, if you will. Okay, I'm not going to ask anybody to believe. I'm going to say you must believe any of these things, but they're my views, and some people might relate to it. Okay, so this is called Night Passages. Dime and penny remain behind in dust on the bureau. I push magazines off the bed, slink down, skinny, into chill sheets, press one hand between arm and ribs, one hand between thighs for warmth. I picture a car in a grassy field, and across the pale, misted world comes Hawk, rusty tail spread. Hawk turns the sky, and a certain falling light sways through me. How can I be this lucency of clouds, this stillness in the icy amber of grasses? A white wolf and his brothers gang together, drive and ambush prey and hunts that last the night. I jolt awake from multiple sleeps, multiple lives tracking wolves. All morning, I find myself ravenous in worship in the marbled shrines of their eyes.
That's Night Passages, the poem written by my guest, Tim Bellows. Is that something that actually happened to you where you were in bed and you had this experience, or is this something that came out of your mind, you imagined it?
Well, frankly, you know, I'm not sure. I write my dreams down as much as I can, but I would say this is, I don't know if this is an actual dream I had, but it's very, very like a dream I might have. You may know sometimes your dreams just shift from place to place and there's no explanation. I find that most people really do dream, but dreams can be a place of a real adventure, and they can be an expansive thing rather than just, oh, I'm going to crash out now. We'll see what I dream. You know, it can be more purposeful.
What do you think dreams are?
Well, to me, from what I understand, they're really messages from the divine. Okay, in other words, they're instructive, if you want to take them that way. They're coming through to provide clues for what our conscious mind, our logical mind, can't really access because it's more rigid.
So for you, they're not just the product of the random electrical firings of a mind, but there are lessons to be learned if you study your dreams.
Yeah, I really feel that. And if we pay attention to it. And certainly that's not everybody's bag, but no. It works for some.
Along with that poem, Night Passages, you've also brought for us a poem by the 13th century Persian poet Rumi. Why did you bring that?
Well, because I think it's the real key to understanding language. And remember I said language can be resonant and can be uplifting through the tones. And I would say the ultimate tone is a sound. It's a very ancient ancient name, actually. It's Coleman Barks calls it in this book. This book is called Like This by Rumi. Coleman Barks calls this sound, which is hue, H-U, he calls it a word for divine presence. So what I find fascinating, and through reading some of Paul Twitchell's works, I've found it to be true for myself, that this word, if you repeat it or sing it over and over, it can actually call in divine presence into your life, okay, or into your consciousness, and it becomes an actual experience, and it's quite beautiful. So Rumi incorporates this word here, and he speaks of it in a way that shows that it seems to be sort of the fluid that everything rides on. So I can just read this.
Okay, please.
Open. I know we don't want to have a really long poem on the air, but to me this is the big key to language and sound. The soul sometimes leaves the body, then returns. When someone doesn't believe that, walk back into my house like this. When lovers moan, they're telling our story like this. I am a sky where spirits live. Stare into this deepening blue while the breeze says a secret like this. When someone asks what there is to do, light the candle in his hand like this. How did Joseph's scent come to Jacob? How did Jacob's sight return? A little wind cleans the eyes like this. When the spiritual teacher comes back from Tabriz, he'll put his head around the edge of the door to surprise us like this.
Wow. It seems almost like the poem came to a sudden end.
Yeah, poems can do that. Sometimes they'll just end on a funny image or a hard image, and you kind of want to go back and see what you're supposed to make of all this. It takes poetry is that slow talk that takes time to digest, and I think that's why many people don't spend time with it.
I don't know how close to the original Persian this translation is, but did Rumi anchor his poems in the kind of concrete words that you seek to do?
Well,
we think of his
often,
poems as esoteric.
Yeah, yeah, they are. Often they're teaching stories, and they do have funny things about people in the market, and there's concrete language. I plucked out my feathers and became a fool. So you have feathers, and they're a little more abstract. You're right, but there are situations, a little teaching situations. Rumi was one of a kind. I think he is one of the most popular poets in the country now, because I think people want, if you will, spiritual truth, and he's very direct on it.
It's pretty extraordinary that someone who lived about 700 years ago in Central Asia would be so popular in America in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, again, I think that's what people want, so it's coming back, and we have some really great translators of Rumi making it. Coleman Barks, for one, is making it into a more modern sound for everybody, and a lot of people are just, if they catch on to it, they're just crazy about Rumi, because there's nobody who's quite pushing the envelope as far as he does, I believe.
And finally, Tim, your next book is called Writing from the Diamond Core. It's not out yet, but it's a guide to writing poetry, correct?
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And I think it's going to be pretty radical because, again, it's talking about, it's the basic claim, I guess, just to give it all away, is that if we're going to be a better poet and a stronger person overall, and if we're going to be truth tellers, as poet Joy Harjo would call it, dealing with poetry, we need to craft our consciousness first. In other words, consciously work in a higher state of consciousness in order to have a higher state in a poem that you're going to create, if you will. So that's kind of how I see it. So I'm trying to go back to the source point. And I have found that singing this sound that Rumi mentions, this HU sound, just singing it gently over and over again to myself about 10 or 20 minutes every day for sure, gives me some definite experiences in spirit. So it's not all theory. That's kind of where I'm coming from.
Wow. Well, that's Tim Bellows, poet. His most recent collection of poems is Sunlight from Another Day. He teaches at Sierra College in Rockland. Tim, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure meeting you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more on our guests and topics, go to capradio.org/insight. Today's associate producers were Lynn Weaver and Nathan Wilkinson. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us. Do you remember watching the A-Team or the Rockford Files on TV? Ever wonder about the person who wrote and produced them? On the next Insight, you'll meet writer Stephen J. Cannell and hear about his latest project. Also, Vive la Food is a locally made documentary that tells the story of two French chefs who've made their livings in Sacramento. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight
tomorrow afternoon at 2 on Capital Public Radio.